to go through some housekeeping announcements?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Powelson, and good afternoon, everybody. This is, yes, we're on the record. Okay. Good afternoon again, everybody. Welcome to the second half of today's presentations. I want to thank the panelists this morning for keeping within their time frames, and we'll ask that the panelists this afternoon also keep within the time strictures for your particular panel. I do have time cards, so that with the yellow card, it means you have about a minute, and then the red card means your time is up. Okay, again, as was stated this morning, written comments will be invited following today's proceedings, and the due date is March the 28th for all comments, except the consumer education comments will be due on April the 4th. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Judge Rainey. Our first presenter this afternoon will be Ms. Andrea Williams, Senior Director of Regulatory Strategy and Policy for NRG Energy. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. I'm the Senior Director of Regulatory Strategy and Policy
Having a hard time hearing.
Better? Let's try it again. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. As you heard earlier, NRG owns three active EGSs participating in Pennsylvania: Energy Plus, Green Mountain, and Reliant. I'm excited to have the opportunity to talk to you today, and I heard that y'all might be a little bit interested in Texas. So considering I've been working in that market for about 12 years, I thought I'd give it a shot and see how we do. I recognize, of course, that Pennsylvania is not Texas, but I do think that the Texas market serves as a good template as we evaluate some of the models that your staff has put before us with respect to default service and other market enhancements. I've kind of picked my own top five that I want to talk to you about very quickly based on my time constraints, so bear with me. Some of those are the price to beat, or PTB as we affectionately call it in Texas, Polar, Billing, Universal Service, and of course, customer protections. So starting off with PTB, I think one of the key things to remember is that contrary to popular belief, in Texas there was no default service or anything analogous to what you have here in Pennsylvania. Texas had essentially a one-time only do nothing and get something approach. What I mean by that is January 1st, 2002, any customer that hadn't actively shopped was transitioned to what you would be here, the affiliated EGS, based on their utility service area. Affiliated EGSs were required to offer the price to beat and only the price to beat for 3 years, or until you lost 40% of your customer load, whichever happened first. Importantly, PTB also was designed as a transitional product only, and it had a firm end date 5 years after the onset of competition. Affiliated EGSs could adjust that price to beat twice per year based on underlying wholesale market conditions. There was no reconciliation, though, and the message was always very clear from the commission: use your two bullets very wisely, because you don't get any other bites at the apple, and there's no opportunity to otherwise recover fuel costs. Similar to Texas, I think it's imperative here in Pennsylvania to continue to ensure that the default pricing mechanism reflects the underlying wholesale market conditions, because that was a linchpin in the design and ultimate success of the Texas model, and I'm certain that you can have similar, if not greater, successes of your own here in Pennsylvania. Today, as you likely know, in Texas there is no more affiliated EGS. All suppliers are free to offer any variety of products and services as they so choose, and customers choose what they want every single day. Since Pennsylvania, though, has the benefit of already having active participants in your market, which is not something that Texas had, I think you are uniquely positioned to enable something like the EGS community, for example, to serve the role that the affiliated EGS had to serve in Texas. I know that was the big one, so I'll run through the others pretty quickly. Moving on to Polar, another misnomer there is that Polar is the default service here. That's also not the case, as you may know. Polar is simply for the instances where the retail supplier goes out of business. There are a couple of different ways that you can be the poller. You can volunteer to be the poller, or you can be assigned the poller based on your load ratio share. Poller, too, is essentially LMP. But I think it's important to know that even in the rare instances when we've had a poller event in Texas, those customers have had the opportunity to discuss with those, the poller provider in advance and perhaps choose a better product that most appropriately meets their needs. So those customers have a positive experience too. You might be interested to note that with all the fear of poller, there was a poller event in 2008 was the last one that happened in Texas, and it affected less than 1% of all customers in the market. Third, with respect to the coveted bill that we all talk about so much, in Texas, the supplier does all of the billing. And this is important because it furthers the relationship that, the retailers have with customers. It enables us to build our brand, have the one-on-one conversations with customers that we need to continue to develop those innovative products and services, and essentially eliminates the middleman from the design. I would call the Texas market your POR in reverse. Suppliers there pay the utilities charges upon receipt, which essentially eliminates the bad debt risk, which I'm certain the utilities would like here. EGSs, as a result, bear full responsibility for collection of bad debt, and they do have the ability to tell the utility when to disconnect service. But that's not without significant commission rules to address how that can be handled in a safe and appropriate manner. Furthermore, by giving suppliers the ability to manage the billing, you break them the important cycle that has existed today of stymieing competition because either the utility's dinosaur system doesn't currently meet the needs of the market, or you have ratepayers paying yet again for something that will in very short order be an outdated utility system. Moving on to the universal service programs, which I know is a very important fact for all of us. In Texas, it's essentially a standardized program. Suppliers are indifferent as to whether a customer gets any sort of discount or not because they are able to be reimbursed for a credit that's given to all customers. It's a great opportunity for customers to be assured that when they shop there, they have the same opportunities to pick whatever product or service best meets their needs and still get those very important discounts that are applicable to them. The program is generally recovered through what's called the system benefits charge, which is a non-bypassable charge that all customers pay. I understand that here in Pennsylvania, there is a group underway that's looking at opportunities for how we can continue to afford that customer segment benefits and do it in a manner similar to Texas. I think that is very encouraging. Finally, with respect to customer protections, it's on the forefront of the mind of the Texas commissioners, as you well know, and all market participants, just as it is here in Pennsylvania. Texas has thorough and very detailed customer protection rules. In fact, I gave Karen a book today just to kind of show an example of what I carry around to most of my meetings. There are things that dictate that billing, disclosures, reconnect, disconnect, deposits, deferred payment plans, disclaimers, advertising, slamming. Essentially, the list in Texas terms is as long as the Rio Grande. And we have a hard time keeping up, but it's very important. And even a decade later, in Texas, we continue to finesse those rules as our market matures. That brings to mind another point about finessing the rules that I think it's important to discuss, and that is that I would strongly caution it against a further re-review, as I'll call it, of the policies that we move forward with here. As you know, any market needs regulatory certainty to thrive, and the retail community is anxious to participate here, and I think it would be an unfortunate outcome, absent that certainty, for us to not be able to provide the investment this commission and we so long to provide to the consumers here in Pennsylvania. So with that, I'll stop talking about Texas and let you know that NRG is very excited about the retail opportunities that exist here in Pennsylvania, and we're anxiously awaiting to see how y'all do it, Pennsylvania style, of course.
Thank you. Our next presenter is Mr. Richie Hudson, State Chairman for the Retail Energy Supply Association. Welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. First of all, I'd just like to start by commending this commission and staff in particular for their leadership and tireless efforts in the intermediate work plan final order and the discussion that's taking place today on the future of default service. While not all of RESA's recommendations have ultimately been adopted throughout this process, we do believe that the process has been very open, very transparent, very fair to all of the stakeholders, and the final outcomes that we've seen so far have truly represented a well-crafted and thoughtful balancing of the views of all of the stakeholders, which, as you know, do have a lot of diversity among them. Now, moving to RESA's position on the in-state default service models. From the beginning, RESA has recognized that there are many possible in-state retail market designs and implementation plans that can further the evolution to a more properly functioning and robust competitive retail market here in the Commonwealth. RESA has consistently advocated for an in-state default service design that reduces or eliminates continued reliance on the incumbent EDC as the default service provider. And in this respect, we believe that the discussion document put forth by staff in the RMI process represents significant progress, because all three of the models that are under consideration in that discussion document would shift the default service responsibility away from the EDC and onto competitive EGS providers. As staff has properly recognized in this discussion document, any future retail market design should distinguish between the concept of a default service and the concept of a backstop provider of last resort service. As Andrea mentioned, this is an element of the successful market design in Texas. RESA's position as to the specific three models that were put forth in the discussion document, we believe that models A and B can be workable solutions for an in-state retail market design, model A being reliance on a pricing structure that is priced at the prevailing LMP plus an adder to appropriately reflect additional retail servicing costs. And model B, which could take the form of an index or a competitive procurement process to select the EGS default service provider. Our preference is for model A, given the success that hourly pricing has shown to be a very successful model at promoting further stimulation of retail market competition in Pennsylvania and in other states. We would, however, caution against model C, and I'll talk about that. Model C is more or less a continuation of the status quo with an extensive regulatory review process for a mandated portfolio approach to default service procurement. Both models A and models B, as I mentioned, would rely on the EGS to provide default service, with the EDC providing a backstop service. We feel this is important progress for several reasons. First of all, by de-emphasizing the continued role of EDC-provided default service, this allows new entrants to enter the market and quickly and easily achieve economies of scale and scope. Secondly, this would help to mitigate the brand loyalty that currently exists and the status quo bias that exists in favor of the incumbent EDC. Thirdly, by relying on EGSs to provide default service, the anti-competitive effects of failing to fully unbundle all customer care, general billing, general overhead, and other generation-related costs from distribution rates would be partially mitigated. And it would also eliminate the problems with the messy cost reconciliation process that some of the other panelists have discussed earlier in the day. While we think the staff discussion document is on the right track towards an in-state default service design, both models A and B do raise the central question of what happens after the end of the initial two-year period. Is this new EGS-provided default service intended to be a perennial option that's available in the market? Or, in RESA's view, this should just be an additional transitional measure towards a final end state where there's no longer the need for any product beyond the basic backstop service. As I mentioned earlier, we would caution against Model C, which, or any model where the EGS providing default service must file detailed procurement plans subject to extensive litigation before the commission. We believe the PUC can maintain broad oversight authority over a regulatory process to select the EGS default service providers and define the pricing structure for EGS provided default service, but not hamstring EGSs in their hedging and procurement activities, as some of the Act 129 standards would do. Finally, I would just note that changes to the default service model only represent the first step in this process, and there's an additional evolution that can take place with things like eventually eliminating the EDC's role in providing this backstop polar service, implementation of an economically viable supplier consolidated billing option, like Andrea mentioned, fully unbundling and removing all generation-related cost components from distribution rates, and working to make all universal service program funds portable so low-income customers can get full access to the benefits of the competitive market. Finally, I'd like to thank you again for your leadership on this important discussion, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Our next presenter is Mr. Chris Weston, President and Chief Executive Officer of Direct Energy. And before I turn it over to Chris, I want to thank you for your continued investment here in our Commonwealth. I remember your acquisition of Gateway Services in Pittsburgh, and appreciate all that you've done to promote competitive markets here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Chris Weston.
Thank you very much, Chairman Palson. I appreciate those kind words. Good afternoon, Chairman Palson and commissioners, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. You should note that I am speaking today on behalf of not only Direct Energy, but also Dominion Retail and IGS. And firstly, I would like to echo some of the thoughts we've heard today about the show appreciation for the way that you have approached this, being open-minded and thoughtful in how you develop the power market in Pennsylvania. We also appreciate the interim measures that you are establishing. We believe that the way to restructure the power market and enhance competition is a significant opportunity for Pennsylvania, for its businesses, and its consumers. Competition, as you know, brings many benefits, not least of which is innovation in terms of tariffs, products, maybe their green products, maybe their services, HVAC services, and energy efficiency. It is the most efficient mechanism for regulating prices, ensuring that they are as low as practicable and excessive returns are not generated. Competition in itself does not guarantee low prices. That is a function of commodity prices and generation mix. But it does guarantee the lowest prices given those fundamentals. Competition, in short, is the best way to regulate prices. It is good for the economy, for businesses where input costs are lower, and for consumers who retain their hard-earned cash. My comments today are based on experience in both the UK market and Texas. There are other markets around the world, like Australia and closer to home in Georgia, where they have a similar end state. And the end state I outline has been in place and been successful for many years, 12 to 13 years in the case of the UK. So just to consider the UK market in a bit more detail, there, customers are very engaged in the energy market. About 100,000 of them switch supplier every week. Prices in the UK are lower than the rest of Europe. In gas, they are the cheapest across Europe, and in power, they are consistently in the lowest quartile. Competition and associated innovation has driven energy efficiency, and this has resulted in the reduction of customer usage by about 2 to 5% each year. And that goes straight to energy companies' bottom lines. But it does provide savings for customers. And we, as an energy company, we support this, we encourage it, and we drive it. To achieve these types of outcomes requires a market structure that ensures sustainable competition. It requires the engagement of consumers. And competitors are able to create a relationship with their customers, and that requires that they serve and bill those customers. It also requires recognition that a regulator's role is to design the market structure that best supports competition, to implement that structure, and then to monitor how it functions, not set prices, which we believe should be left to the market. In our view, the end state that is most economically efficient and supports competition recognizes the different elements in the value chain and requires price regulation only of the natural monopoly. In power, generation can be competitive, as can retail. The natural monopoly is the transmission and distribution network. This should be recognized in the market structure. This could also apply to gas markets. The ideal end state requires that the utility does not compete in the retail space and concentrates on the reliable delivery of power, investing in, building, and maintaining the networks, the natural monopoly, where returns should be regulated. It is, however, okay for the utility to have an affiliate in the retail space, but that entity should operate entirely independently and not share the same brand. Retailers in this market structure provide service to customers. In terms of direct energy, we believe it is important to be able to bill the customer, and that's bill in entirety, so including network charges. To be able to answer service calls and collect payments, and as a last resort, where necessary, have an ability to disconnect via the utility. That allows retailers to create a relationship with the customer and engage the customer, driving category interest and innovation. Default service is not part of this model and is not necessary. Firstly, from experience in the UK and Texas, from those competitive markets, customers do not go without service. It simply does not happen. In fact, default service provides an option to do nothing, a choice you could argue that the customer should be able to make, but a choice that does not recognize the benefits of competition. Another concern that must be considered is low-income customers. It is important that this is properly considered. The competitive market can provide service to these customers and should do so. Service does not need to be provided by the utility. Low-income customers, like all customers, will benefit from the natural mechanism that competition provides for keeping prices low. Secondly, support can be provided via government policy, either directly or via retailers, possibly in the form of a non-bypassable charge. These mechanisms are currently deployed and work in both the UK and Texas. I recognize that this model is different from the transitional models that you are proposing, all of which, I have to say, are an improvement on the current structure. We believe, though, that the interim models, the transitional models, are not necessary. There is plenty of time before the 1st June 2015 date to put in place the end state I have outlined, and I urged the PUC to do so. Direct Energy now has over 100,000 customers in Pennsylvania. We serve an additional 7 terawatt hours of load to our C&I customers and employ over 1,000 people, a number that is growing. We would like to invest more, and the steps that you are taking encourage companies like mine to do so. You have a fantastic opportunity in Pennsylvania to restructure the power and possibly gas markets, to drive innovation and economic benefit, and I urge you to take it. I talk to politicians and regulators in other states who are extremely interested in developments here and are taking or beginning to take similar steps themselves. I appreciate the opportunity to give my views today and fully support the continued evolution of a market structure that supports and encourages vibrant competition. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next presenter is Mr. Tony Banks, Vice President of Competitive Market Policies for First Energy Solutions. Tony, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the Commission for this opportunity to present First Energy Solutions ideas. What I am picking up from this whole process is that anyone that says they didn't have an opportunity to be engaged, they're really barking up the wrong tree, because anyone that had a thought or idea about what is going on with the IWP and this decision on in-state default service has an opportunity to present their ideas. So what I'd like to start with is, again, we always have a fundamental, and it's grounded in the idea that we really do want to try to protect the customer every opportunity we get. We absolutely believe that focusing on the product for in-state default service is the right thing to do. But what I'd like to do then is talk about what we think that in-state default service can look like starting June 15. And the one thing I'll get right off the table is we do believe that the EGS can provide that service. So everything that I say will be consistent with that idea, as well as consistent with other comments I've made in the past, including the June 8th en banc. So I'm not a lawyer, so I won't even venture down the path of what requires legislative change or not, and I don't think we should be concerned about that in this process. We need to try to figure out what works and what's right and deal with legislation if it has to be dealt with. So following our views of the different options that were presented, I wanted to focus on those since they were laid out by the staff. First of all, we agree that June 15 is a viable start date for in-state default service. And it should be a two-year product, because it's not so long that you don't get a chance to correct, and it's not so short that it hasn't had a chance to work. So we believe that Model A is the right approach, so I want to talk a little bit about that. Even though we also think that Model A can be the most disruptive to customers on the surface, and I'll talk a little bit about how we think that you can deal with that, but we do believe that whatever we do with default service, regardless of how disruptive it is, it should be just a last-ditch option for customers to have service, and primarily only those customers that are brought back to default service because of a default of an EGS in the marketplace. So in many ways, it's consistent with some of the other ideas that you've heard here. We think the market price should be competitively bid on the administrative adder piece, so it should be a market-based price. With a competitively bid administrative adder, you have an option for an additional commission adder if you think there's some funding requirements to perhaps fund education and other objectives of the commission. We think that that monthly price should only change monthly, as described. So even if you're using a daily real-time price, we think that should be converted to a monthly price adjusted in each EDC for the actual cost of delivering power to those EDCs. But the important thing that we think has to be done at the same time, if you're going to go to the in-state default service on June 15, is you have to have a methodology for moving all of the customers away from that, because today they have the feeling of being protected by default service. So somehow we need to capture that and maintain that feeling. So again, consistent with what we've said in the past, we do believe that an opt-out auction to move customers to EGSs is an appropriate way to get customers off default service. So then default service basically becomes a backstop. You may have 2%, 1% of customers remaining on default service. So what that does for default service is it allows more EGSs to be qualified, because now you're only serving 1% of the market on default service. The price is a market-based price, so it minimizes the risk that suppliers will have to undertake in order to serve that default service customer. We also think that then by moving the customers off of the default service through an opt-out auction or some other mechanism, you've now allowed EGSs to openly participate in gaining those customers. But importantly, we do think that should be a competitively bid auction, because as the customers move away from their current protection of default service, they need to have something they think is stable. We think the product should be for 2 years, the same length of time as the in-state default service, so they can both be evaluated together. So basically, that's where we think it can go starting June 15. We looked at Model B. Model B starts to get you closer to that, but when you start talking about prevailing market prices, we see that having the same pitfalls as least cost over time and prudent supply mix. There's no real definition of what that means, so we think that you eliminate that by just going to an hourly price converted to a monthly price with an adder. Option C, I would agree with Richie that you're basically duplicating what we have today. You've substituted the EGS for the EDC, so the question I ask there is, well, what problem are we trying to solve with that? And I couldn't think of one, so I would suggest that option C shouldn't be considered at all. Option B should probably not be considered because of this idea of prevailing market price, which really doesn't have a defined meaning and one that's accepted by everyone. And so I would suggest that we want to move to option A. Lastly, of course, you had a panel talk about this earlier today. Consumer education is going to be absolutely critical. And I think that the messaging, as you move the customers from the current default service to whatever they're going to be on that is not default service, has to be really concise and precise so that they understand that what they're getting in place of what they have today is not worse than what they had. So consumer education is absolutely important, but for the most part, we think that option A is the right model to go to. So that concludes my comments. I look forward to any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. And our last presenter on this panel is Mr. Gene Allison, Senior Vice President of PPL Energy. Gene, welcome back.
Thank you. Chairman Powelson and commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to participate today in this important discussion about the future of Pennsylvania's competitive retail electricity market. I'm going to eliminate some of my redundant comments based on my colleagues already speaking to some of those issues and just raise my presentation up a little bit from a high-level standpoint. With thoughtful public policy and the PUC's engaged leadership, Pennsylvania is viewed as a leader in the implementation of electric choice. While the state has had an impressive start, I commend the Commission for not being lulled into thinking that the full benefits of a competitive retail market have been achieved. On the contrary, we believe we're just scratching the surface. For today's panel, the Commission asked participants to summarize their views of an ideal end state. PPL Energy Plus believes that achieving the end state requires time, continued strong leadership from the Commission, and most likely, legislative action. The ultimate end state should be one in which consumers have many choices on products and services, as well as price. These choices can only be enabled by technology and the creativity of a vibrant, competitive market. The ultimate end state advances retail choices in the same way that vibrant, competitive markets launched advanced mobile communication technologies, streaming video, social media, and others, just to name a few. In this end state, EDCs are infrastructure companies. Consumers go to the competitive market not only for electricity supply, but also for services that make their lives easier, such as billing, information, demand response, ancillary services, distributed generation, energy efficiency, and conservation. This ultimate end state most closely aligns with Model A, but takes that model much further. It opens doors for true product innovation and uses available and emerging technologies to put the real power of choice in the hands of consumers. If the measure of retail competition is the number of customers switching to suppliers, we are doing okay. If the measure is innovation and the choices that customers have to meet their needs and make their lives easier, further success is worth striving for. In the current model, suppliers are chasing a price to compare, like Wile E. Coyote in the old Roadrunner cartoons. What passes for innovation is really marketing. Suppliers find it difficult to innovate because access to customer information, technologies, and services is delayed by current technology platforms and market structure. To unleash the real potential of the competitive market, we have to give suppliers the incentives and the abilities to innovate. The transition to the end state, as I've described, will not be easy. It will require leadership, and it will require every participant to be engaged in establishing a well-defined, transparent, and properly regulated market. To achieve the end state vision that I have described, the Commission should take and be looking into address the following basic default service concepts. First, EDCs should become infrastructure companies. They should enable the competitive market to drive solutions faster, more creative than we can imagine today. Second, the default service model should be a true default, a temporary stop until the next choice. Consumers should view default service as a transition, not a competitive option. Third, the competitive market should provide market-driven and consumer-driven products and services. Regulatory frameworks should enable the market. In the ideal end state, consumer behavior reflects their interests, products and services, and their values, price, just like other commodity markets. I want to thank the Commission for its continued interest in the competitive retail electricity market and its willingness to build on the momentum gained in the current transition period.
Thank you. I'm going to recognize Commissioner Cawley. We're going to go out of order here. We'll go right, left now. So, Commissioner Cawley.
Well, since I'm the lawyer on this panel, let me get to the legal question here. Act 129 added provisions for default service. Specifically, it required a portfolio approach to acquiring default supply. Long-term, medium-term, short-term, spot market acquisition of the default supply. And the standard became least cost to customers over time. So if we change the default supplier from the electric distribution company to one or more EGSs, is legislation required, or do EGSs presently require supply now in a fashion that would meet that statutory requirement of a portfolio approach and a price that is the least cost to customers over time?
Even though I'm not a lawyer, I guess I'll take the first stab at answering that question. And it is a good question. I mean, RESA has consistently advocated that we do not believe legislation is needed to move towards one of these types of end-state models that staff has outlined in its discussion document. And as you properly noted, any EGS that is operating prudently in the market is going to have, as part of their overall procurement strategy, a portfolio of wholesale contracts that include all of the components that are mandated by Act 129. So I don't believe any legislation is needed in order to adopt either Model A or Model B.
I suspect it'll come down to the end state that is adopted as to whether it requires legislation or not, and I'm not an expert in that area, but it would probably be wise to ensure that the legislature was supportive of what we are doing or what is being proposed here. In terms of the way that retailers hedge, they will look to hedge to optimize gross margin and reduce their costs. And I think you have got a good opportunity in a competitive market with many price points out there and many competitors to ensure that you have the lowest price possible out there in the market and the customer to be able to choose that. I don't think that you need a default service provider or default service supply to be able to do that.
Tony?
Yeah, again, I'm not a lawyer, but when I think of lease costs over time, I think the only thing you need to look at, if you compare the cost of default service over the last couple of years to the price that's been available in the marketplace, you can make the argument that whatever procurement strategies that were deployed did not result in the lease cost over time. So I think there's always this debate about what is the right portfolio. And as a layman or someone that would look at the markets reasonably, I can make a strong argument that daily spot is the best portfolio with zero any other category. So I think there's probably more flexibility in determining what lease cost over time really entails when you think about portfolio approach. But again, I don't know what that means from a legislative perspective, but I think that we can probably broaden our thinking relating to what we think the right portfolio mix is.
I would only add that I would echo Chris's comment. I mean, I think for us to move this forward in the direction I think that is best for the marketplace and the consumer, legislators are stakeholders in this process, and I think all stakeholders have to be engaged, I think, to get to the end result I think we all desire.
Well, Tony, it's interesting you say that, because I've had a hard time explaining to people that even though the standard is least cost to customers over time, how a lower price that's being uniformly offered, usually by all the competitors, is a better price. Why isn't that the least cost to customers over time? So it would appear that for the most part, the alternative suppliers are providing a better price than what the statute provides from the default supplier. In fact, that's exactly why you can compete. And I keep trying to explain that usually the default supplier with the portfolio approach must acquire at least in the, for part of the portfolio, contracts ahead of time, and the generator does not know at that point what his or its costs are, and therefore there's a risk premium involved. And there's a further risk premium involved because the generator is bearing the risk of customer migration. So may not be able to sell as much to the default supplier as they originally anticipate. So I just so you know, it's been my view that the statutory standard can be met, and in fact is being exceeded by alternative suppliers already. But I'm going to wait for the consumer advocate's view on that point, because I know that Sonny may have a different view on what the statutory meaning is. Is there any incentive for the EDC to keep customers? Unless, of course, we've approved a provider of last resort program that provides for a fixed price that is way above market now. But if we don't provide for a default service plan that locks in a price that is soon beaten substantially by the market, does an electric distribution company as the default supplier have any reason to hang on to customers?
In my opinion, they should not have any reason to hang on to customers. As you've noted, there are variants of a default service plan that exist in the Commonwealth today where the regulated utility does have an opportunity to earn a profit on the provision of default service because the particular plan in that instance was a fixed price default service rate where there was no competitive bid out of the wholesale supply. But for the rest of the EDC's default service plans, there should be no logical reason for the utility to want to remain in that function. And as many others have commented on, shifting that commodity procurement away from the regulated utility onto the competitive market frees up resources for the regulated utility to focus on their core responsibility, which is maintaining the wires and poles and ensuring adequate and reliable delivery of electricity service to customers.
And that's where they earn the majority of their return from the infrastructure that they're investing in and focusing on. I mean, the only instance where they may have an incentive, not necessarily to hold on to customers, but to grow a customer base, is if they have an affiliate in the retail market space with appropriate transparency and separation around it, and that may be a commercial enterprise that they wish to pursue.
Thank you. Okay. Commissioner Gardner. We're moving down the line. We're going right to left. He's going left. He's going. Do you have a question?
Yeah, but we'll talk about it later.
Okay.
My question is to all the panelists, and I guess I'm a little bit troubled by the answers around the need to meet the requirements of Act 129, and in particular the least cost over time provision. And I'd like to get some further expansion on that because I see the default service as just a single product in your offering. And if you aren't able to differentiate that product, then maybe that's not the business you want to be in. So does anyone want to comment on that?
1 second, please.
I'll do my best. I'm not sure it's a direct answer to the question because I'm not sure I fully understand it. But any retailer in the market will have a very sophisticated view in how they hedge their customer load. And they'll look at the market, they'll look at the wholesale market, which has to be liquid, and they will have hedging strategies around that. And they have every incentive in a competitive market to do that in the most efficient way it can and provide energy at the lowest cost. And that, to me, sounds like that it would meet the conditions required under Act 129. Now, there are a lot of players in the market. They will have different hedging strategies. Not everyone is going to have the lowest cost position all of the time. But you do have then the capability for customers in a completely competitive market to make a choice as to whether they want to move suppliers to go after price, or they may be happy to stay where they are to enjoy the service and the other benefits that they may get around the product and the services that are offered to them by that retailer. But the mechanism of the competitive market and the multitude of the competitors and the sophistication of the way they look at the wholesale market and they hedge out their load should meet that requirement.
Again, my point is that if the default supply is only a proportion of the overall customer load in any current EDC territory, that is a separate and distinct product in my mind. And that product needs to meet a specific statutory requirement. And if you aren't prepared to entertain that as a requirement, it may preclude you from being in the default supply business. No further questions.
Well, I think from my point of view, I would view the lease cost over time standard as more broadly, and I think to analyze that, you have to look at what was the original intent of the original electric restructuring legislation, combine that with the changes that were in Act 129. The original restructuring legislation clearly stated that economic forces are more effective than competitive market forces are more effective than economic regulation at controlling the cost of energy. And Act 129, even though it tweaked the procurement standards for default service, it maintained provisions that set up default service as a backstop to the competitive market. The language basically says default service is there for customers that are otherwise unable to obtain supply in the competitive market, or if their generation service provider is unable to provide the service that's contracted for. So in my mind, I think it's clear that the legislative intent is for default service to be a backstop to the market, and the overall objective of the lease cost over time standard is to say that all customers, not just default service customers, but all customers have a market model that delivers to them the lease cost service over time. Not just those customers that are on default service, but those customers that are participating in the competitive market. And as we all know, the lease cost service means different things to different people. The lease cost to me, if I value renewable energy, is considerably different than the lease cost to someone down the street who's only interested in price certainty and the lowest possible price. So I think you have to take a more broader view of what the lease cost over time standard is.
Okay. Richie, are you sure you didn't go to law school?
Maybe eventually I'll get there.
They have an online program if you want. Commissioner Whitmer.
Thank you. I'm going to beat this horse a little bit more, but just for a very short period of time. I'm not an attorney either, but I do recognize the importance and the important role that the legislature has played in setting up both the DREG Act and Act 129. And I would encourage all of you in your comments to us to indicate why you think the proposals either do meet and conform with the acts or they don't. And I think that would be very helpful to all of us as we move forward on this. One other question for Mr. Alessandrini. You'd mentioned in your comments that you think the EDC should be an infrastructure company. What do you mean by that specifically?
Specifically, I mean transmission, distribution, and metering technologies. I think that the best other sources of technology are driven from market solutions, and that could be from software to hardware to product development, pricing and unique product structure. So I think today utilities are very good at what they do, which I would, you know, basically say is the reliability of the system. And I think focusing them on those energies in that area is, I think, benefits the market. I think if we want to utilize technology more efficiently, if we want to be able to diversify product offerings and solutions to customers, I think the delivery of those are better from a competitive marketplace, you know, than a regulatory framework.
Okay. So from, you know, if we look at it from a metering perspective, you're including then moving over into the Act 129 realm, some of the, you know, the innovative products that can be offered from as a result of smart meters, I'm assuming?
That's correct. I think it's vitally important that the industry has the ability to access the data and structure products that meet customers' needs at a pace far greater and far more significant than it's current today. And I think the only way to do that is to make the information accessible to all market participants and to all consumers, so that way they can make more informed decisions that better meet their lifestyle and their choices than one that is, you know, a regulatory framework that is done in, you know, over very small steps over a long period of time.
So the EDC wouldn't be offering the products, but the information that they would gain would be available to all of the market participants, EGSs.
That's correct.
Not the EDCs to offer. Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you. Vice Chairman Coleman.
I'm one more second. Sorry. I think Mr. Banks wanted to respond.
Yeah, just briefly. I generally agree with Mr. Alessandrini. I think the data needs to be made available to all market participants, but I think that if we're talking about a June 1 start date, it's probably important that the EDC continue to provide data management and billing services. I think there needs to be a standard, though, developed for EDC so that they can offer suppliers the the ability to bill value-added services. So, for example, they need to be able to brand the supplier, they need to be able to revise bill formats and things like that, offer rate ready, bill ready. And to the extent they can't do that, I think you make a faster push for suppliers to be able to do their own consolidated billing. But we have to recognize there are a lot of suppliers in Pennsylvania today that cannot do supplier consolidated billing. So we need to think of it as a transition to the extent we're going to go in that direction and make it incumbent on the EDC to prove that they deserve the right to continue to provide billing and data management services.
I'll just add to that, since we have a chance to volley here, that I fundamentally understand, you know, what Tony's saying there. I think the challenge we have in that direction, though, is that today I have six different utilities with six different technology platforms and six different systems. And if you really want product innovation, I can't customize it to each EDC. I can, but then the ability to innovate is going to be slowed, the cost to innovate is going to be slowed, and the benefit to the consumer is going to be slowed. So it is obviously a very difficult process, and as I mentioned in my discussion here, not an easy process. But I think at the end day, if you frame out the end state, I think it's almost impossible for us not to realize that technology has to be driven by technology companies and not by electric utility company.
Vice Chairman Coleman.
Thank you, Chairman. I want to go back to the comment about regulatory certainty, and just so I'm clear on this point, with the three options that are being proposed, do any of you believe that there is not regulatory certainty in any one of those three options?
Maybe I'll start. I think that my comment specifically in the matrix that staff has put out, there's a column there for review and evaluation, and each of the models essentially has the same time period, you know, January 1st, 2016 through July. That, I guess, perhaps could use some clarification, because when you see things like review and evaluation of where we are, it does inherently bring to mind whether or not we're going to have a fit or a start, if you will, along this process. And so ensuring, it's one thing to evaluate and continue to move forward. It's another thing to evaluate and perhaps pause or reconsider what you've already done. And I think that's part of the overall crux that we've been in for a little while here in Pennsylvania.
I would agree with that. I mean, the more clarity there is around the end state model rather than the two-year transition, the more certainty that creates for competitors coming into the market. So that the more clarity that can be provided by the PUC on that, the better, I think.
You know, with that being said, I guess it causes me to to wonder the comment about the an acknowledgement that option A does have perhaps the most disruption to it. Does that in your mind cause regulatory uncertainty in any respect?
I guess since I use the word disruption, I'll take a crack at that. I think the exact opposite. As long as it's defined, I think that the regulatory certainty is there. The disruption comment was relating to what customers might see, and we need to be very careful that they don't go from something that looks like a duck to something that looks like a horse. And so that was the disruptive comment, but I agree with the others that to the extent we can define what the model's going to look out as far out in the future as we can, the more certainty you have from a regulatory perspective, and then suppliers know what they're dealing with and can evaluate whether or not it makes sense to come into Pennsylvania.
Okay. Right, and I would actually challenge the notion that option A would result in significant disruption to customers. If all customers in the Commonwealth today were on a product that was reflective of the hourly LMP plus a reasonable adder, they would probably be paying less than, they would certainly be paying less over time than they would if they were on default service. And in most cases, they'd be paying less than they are on fixed price products offered by the competitive market. And a continuation of a default service product that relies on 12 and 24 month fixed price contracts results in customers continually receiving price shock and disruption as those contracts renew and expire. And customers face additional disruption when there are market anomalies like cost reconciliation process where the utility under recovers costs in a particular quarter, and then in the next quarter, customers are hit with a 39% rate increase, which has happened here in the Commonwealth. So I think there are significant disruptions that would actually be eliminated from a customer's perspective if you were to adopt Model A.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. I'll just have one question. I'll direct it to Mr. Weston. You made a very big corporate decision to move your North American headquarters from Toronto, Canada to Houston, Texas. Give me some of the drivers and why you left Canada to go to Texas, and why not Pennsylvania? By the way, let me also give a quick disclaimer. It's nice to see First Energy and Direct Energy sitting next to each other. So.
I suspected you might ask this question, Chairman. Well, part of the reason is that the market structure in Ontario is not conducive to a competitive retail market. So the wholesale market structure, there is a wholesale market, but there's a considerable amount of generation that is contracted for outside that market through bilateral agreements and then added into the customer's bill as a separate line item. And it cannot be hedged against, it cannot be forecast, it changes month on month, and it makes it impossible to deliver a proposition to the customer. And that is at the very heart of the issues in Ontario that have led to us to move our corporate headquarters. We are not exiting Ontario. We still have a significant number of customers there, particularly for services. We are simply moving the headquarters. We have, I think, shown quite considerable commitment to Pennsylvania. We did headquarter our direct energy business here. We do have services operations here. And during the consideration of moving the corporate center, there were many factors that we considered. We got very close to coming to Pennsylvania. We did assess that in detail. I think at the end of the day, when we looked at the operation that we have in Texas and the people that we have there, and like Pennsylvania, the market structure, we felt that was probably the right place for the corporate HQ. I hope that that does not undermine any commitment we have shown to Pennsylvania, or indeed will continue to show to Pennsylvania.
I always take you on your word, Chris. Well, I want to thank the panel for your participation. Some really good testimony here this afternoon, and look forward to working with you on the end state goals here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So thank you very much. This will lead us in. We're about 15 minutes over schedule here, and our first presenter on the consumer and environmental perspective panel will be our consumer advocate, Mr. Sonny Papowski. Sonny, welcome back.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. The court reporter would like to move her microphone.